Iti.
Iti.
Thus.
Thus.
Tam.
Tam.
Then.
Then.
The sons of Prajapati Daksha known as the Shravasras.
The sons of Prajapati Daksha known as the Shravasras.
Api.
Api.
Also.
Also.
Rajendra.
Rajendra.
From King Parikshit.
From King Parikshit.
Pajasarvatiya.
Pajasarvatiya.
Who were under the impression
that begetting children
was the most important duty.
Muni,
the great sage.
Upetya,
approaching. Narada.
Narada.
I guess you know what that means, right? Narada.
Narada.
Praha.
Said.
Vacha,
words.
Kutani,
enigmatic.
Purvavat,
as
he had done previously.
So
in this verse, there's a few quite interesting words here. One thing that stands out to me is this Prachara Saga Diya, who were under the impression that begetting children was the most important duty. It's quite often the case that when you have conversations with people, especially the community coming from India, and they start talking about your son. The first thing they generally ask is he married yet? And it's like that's the most important thing in life. And we know also, I speak often with the Brahmacharis here, and when their parents hear that they moved to the Brahmacharis, it's like, oh my God, it's the worst thing in the world that could possibly happen to them. They're taking shock of spiritual life. And so we see that for people who are somewhat materialistically inclined to have progeny to expand the kingdom, this is really important. But for those who are spiritually inclined, the most important thing is to become God conscious, to come to the situation where actually pleasing Krishna. And of course, you can please Krishna by having children. There's not a problem there. But Prabhupada would often say that Krishna consciousness means taking the I out of everything and putting Krishna in the center of everything. So if our purpose in having children is to have God-conscious children, then that's perfectly okay. But if our purpose in having children is simply to expand our dynasty and to expand our name and fame, then this is a great announcement. This is a big, big problem. So this is an interesting point here. But the other word here that's really interesting is this kutani. Now there's a word in the Bhagavad Gita which says kuta. Kutas from kasmalam idam. So Krishna is saying, does anyone know what this word means?
Where from?
It's puzzles. It's like a quizzical expression. So where does this come from? So the same here. The kutani is being used to indicate a mystery. So the words that Narada Muni is presenting to the Shravasras as he presented to the Hariasras are a mystery. But who are they a mystery to? Obviously not the Hariasras, because they understood very clearly the 10 points that Narada Muni made. Who are they a mystery to? Oh man, materialistic people. They're completely bewildered about it. I was having a conversation last night with one of the devotees here, and they were talking about their father. And they were just talking about, it's like devotees sometimes, they talk about the body and the things that go on. And for devotees, it seems like they don't really mind discussing the shortcomings or pitfalls of having a material body, and how it's just oftentimes it's just a source of difficulty and source of embarrassment, really, in one sense. But then they were talking about their father, and their father had this disease, similar disease as what they had, but they felt their father felt very embarrassed by it. Actually, it was like a blur on his manhood, if you like, and therefore he didn't discuss it. Not even with his family. His family didn't even know he had this disease for many, many years until he had to have an operation. Because of this deep identification with the body, he wasn't able to discuss it because he felt that, you know, this was a reflection upon him. And yet we see with devotees, okay, we may not be completely off the bodily platform. We may not have progressed that much along the path, but at least we have this, at least theoretical understanding about this body. And that the pains and pleasures of this body are not directly connected to me. There's something separate. This Prabhupada discusses in the Prabhupada. But I just thought this is, you know, like some of the ways that Prabhupada uses the words and translates the words to help us understand the point that's being made here. Very, very important. You know, this word enigmatic means mysterious or very difficult to understand. Actually, I looked it up. I'm not a very educated person, so I have to look it up and see exactly what it meant, because it's not a word that I commonly use. But it means something that's, you know, it's mysterious. And the science of bhakti is very, very, very mysterious to those who are not spiritually inclined. Very mysterious. And we see that, you know, if you try to present Krishna consciousness to someone who's a materialistic person, the general reaction is like, oh, this is all just mythology, or this is just all some phantasmagorical stories, and, you know, all these types of things. You know, why don't you just deal with the reality? You know, often hear them say, you know, I'm interested in reality, this is just all fantasy, what you're talking about. You know, someone who's, you know, a young boy, he's up to lift a mountain, hold above his head for 7 days with the little finger of his left hand, or he can, you know, suck the life out of a big demon, or he can kill. You know, I mean, you look at some of these stories of Krishna. I even remember one time we were traveling in Tasmania, and there's a group that was together, and we're reading the Krishna book. Every night we read Krishna book and have one. And so we were discussing this story of Vidya the gorilla. And, you know, some pretty fantastic things were explained in this story of Krishna fighting with Vidya. And at one point, one of the devotees, he said, "Who wrote that book?" He was just like really puzzled that this sort of thing could even happen, or that it could be recorded in a book. Because oftentimes we also see that, you know, the books we read when we're growing up and stuff, they're all just fiction. It's all just all some stories. So people are habituated to fiction. You know, they have movies and all this. It's all just fiction. All the stuff you see on television is just fiction. But our understanding is the scriptures deal with fact. They deal with things that have actually happened or are going to happen in the future. Just like you see in the 13th chapter of the first canto, Dhritarashtra, Gandhari and Vidura have left the palace, used his palace and used it as a lamenting. And then Narada Muni, you know, he basically philosophically explains to Yudhisthira why he should lament. But then what he does is he tells him what's going to happen. Because Narada Muni, being a pure Lord devotee Krishna, he can see the future. He has this capacity where he can see the future. So he tells him, this is what's going to happen. And then he says, you know, they're going to the southern side of the Himalayas, they're going to sit down there and meditate, and, you know, so many days from now, that Dhritarashtra will, due to the process of meditation, his body will burn up, and Gandhari will enter into the flame. So he explains what's going to happen. And we understand this to be a fact. It's not just some speculation, it's the fact of what happened. And also we see the Bhagavatam, it also describes to us how this age is going to develop. You see the 12th canto, it tells us very, very precisely. Keep in mind, this book was written 5,000, written down 5,000 years ago. And we see that the things that are being described in the Srimad Bhagavatam are actually becoming true. They're happening, they have happened. Even though it was written 5,000 years ago, we can see that what's being described there is happening, has happened, and will happen. And even it describes towards the end of this age, then the Lord will appear as Kalki. So we understand this will happen. The Bhagavatam is very, very important literature, and it's dealing with the reality of this material world. And the whole purpose of the Bhagavatam is to inspire us to give up attachment to this material world, become God conscious, and return back to the spiritual world. So it's a very, very important literature. All right, so I'll read this. There's no prayer book this translation, I'll read the next one as well. O King Parikshit, Narada Muni approached these sons of Prajapati Daksha, who were engaged in tapasya to beget children, and spoke enigmatic words to them, just as he had spoken to their elder brothers. Responsively,
O King Parikshit,
Narada Muni approached these sons of Prajapati Daksha, who were engaged in tapasya to beget children, and spoke enigmatic words to them, just as he had spoken to their elder brothers. So text 30. Dakshayana sangshutna garato negavam mama anvichatana padavim Ratrinam Ratrivatsala. Translation. O sons of Daksha, please hear my words of instruction attentively. You are all very affectionate to your elder brothers, the Hayashvas. Therefore, you should follow their path. So, also, you know, very interesting verse here where Narada is saying to the Savalashas, please hear my instructions attentively. We see the same thing Krishna says. You know, we know that the Bhagavad Gita is broken into three distinct sections, and the middle six sections are kind of like the essence of the instruction. And the very first verse in the seventh chapter, which is the beginning of instructions, Krishna says to Arjuna, he says, now hear from me, O Sankuti, how by practicing yoga and full devotion for me, you can know me in full, free from doubt. And there's a nice verse of a nice class that Prabhupada gave here in Melbourne Temple in 1973 or 4, I think it was, where he emphasizes these words, touch chanu, just here. He really emphasizes this point. And Prabhupada is pointing out how we need to hear attentively, because if we listen carefully, we can actually understand the transcendental science. Whereas if we don't listen attentively, we don't, you know, try to properly understand the instruction. Just like we see with the Hariyashvas, Narada Muni explained to them in four verses. He explained to them. The battery's dead. I can always talk louder. Oh, we've got another one. How many more these you've got to cover? So in four verses he explains, he uses allegories. You know, so he's giving an example to tell the story. But because the Hariyashvas listened, because Narada Muni was potent, and because they were receptive and also themselves fertile, their intelligence was quite fertile. Prabhupada often uses the example of when a man and a woman get married. If the man is potent and the woman is fertile, then children will result. So we see here that in the beginning of the story, Narada Muni is certainly potent. He's a very, very potent preacher, extremely potent. And I remember years ago listening to a Bhagavatam class in Vrindavan. And the speaker was explaining that it's just like with you can listen to the Bhagavatam, the same verse you can listen to from many different speakers, and you'll get different understandings from listening to that verse. But then if you listen to the same class from someone of the depth of realization through a Prabhupada, this knowledge that what he's presenting just goes straight to the heart. So we can see with someone like Narada Muni, because he has this depth of understanding, that when he's presenting the scriptures, when he's presenting the knowledge to different devotees, that it goes directly to their heart and that they understand it. And also because the Hayashvas were fertile, their consciousness was quite fertile, and they listened very carefully, then they received this knowledge. And the same thing is going to happen here with the Savalashvas, because they are also quite elevated, they have clear consciousness, and they listen attentively to Narada Muni's instructions. Therefore, this instruction goes to their heart and they understand Narada Muni's point. They get the point, and therefore they give up their attachment to performing these Tapasya is Tapasya in order to get children, and realize that the point of Tapasya, as I was explaining the other day, Rishabh Devi explains at the beginning of the fifth chapter of the fifth canto, he says, Tapo devyam putra hiyena shakvam, shudya dyasma prama sokhyam thalantam. That the point of Tapasya is not to gain some material benefit. But many people do that, especially those who are Karmakantya. They follow Tapasya in order to get some material benediction, in order to get some material gain. But the real point of Tapasya is to understand the divine. Otherwise you're just wasting time. And we've been here for countless lives, you know, that there's many prayers in the Bhagavatam pointing out that we should actually use this life to understand the Supreme, to understand what is our duty. You know, I was quoting this verse the other day in the seventh canto. Nara Pralatma, he says, Komana Ashad Prakav Dhamam Bhagavatam Durabham Vansam Tanapi Adhuru Bhagavatam. That, you know, an intelligent person from the very beginning of their life should use this shimbo life to practice Dharma. And the point of Dharma is to understand who I am, who is the Supreme Person, and therefore what is my duty. No, it's not just to have some kind of comfortable material life. We see that, you know, it's quite common that people see that the four goals of life are Dharma, Artha, Karma, Moksha. So for them, Dharma means you follow the Buddha's duties, but you know, it's more about having a pious life, more about, you know, getting a good situation in this life. It's got not really that much to do with understanding God. It's a very materialistic approach to religion. And we see throughout the world so many people practicing religion, their approach is largely material. If they're seen as being pious people, they think they've had a successful life. But in devotional service, in the process of bhakti, this is not the goal. The goal is the ultimate satisfaction of Krishna. And this point is made, I think it's in the second chapter of the first canto. There's a few verses there, I don't remember the verses, but I remember the gist of it. And basically it's being explained there that, the purpose of life is to actually, you know, put some city, city means perfection. Some city means like the complete or the most perfect perfection. And Hari Toshinam, Hari obviously means Lord. Toshinam means to satisfy him. So if you satisfy Krishna, you've achieved the complete perfection of life. But then in the next verse it talks about Vana Shama Elihi Kevalam. There's actually, if you don't achieve this point of satisfying Krishna, then your endeavors in Vana Shama are a useless waste of time. So the Bhagavatam, and this is the point that's made right in the beginning of the Bhagavatam, where it says that the Bhagavatam kicks out all these different types of cheating religion, and it just focuses exclusively on understanding what is our purpose in life and how to achieve that. This is the point of the Bhagavatam. This is why, you know, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, this is such an important literature, because it's not bothering with all the fluff or the flowery, you know, the Veda Vata Vata, all the flowery words of the Vedas. It doesn't bother with that sort of stuff. It just focuses clearly on and exclusively on understanding who is the Supreme Person of God, who am I, and what is my duty, and showing us how to achieve the goal of life. It's a very, very important literature. Narayana encouraged Prajapati Daksha's second group of sons by awakening their natural affinity for their brothers. Really, Narayana is a first-class preacher, and you'll see here he's using so many different strategies. Like, you know, with the Haryashvas, they practice Tapasya, you can see they have very clear intelligence, so he's just going to speak with them. Now he's saying, okay, the brothers may be somewhat wary of my preaching, therefore I'll use a tactic. So he goes and he says, straight away he said, your brothers who are very affectionate, you're very affectionate too, you should follow their path. Preaching strategy.
So
they haven't even met their brothers, yeah. But he's using, because that problem says in natural affinity. You know, even though you haven't met them, as soon as you understand the relationship, there's a, like, you know, it's almost like a hardwired affinity. And then And then we see later on in this chapter, he goes to Daksha using another preaching strategy. He's thinking, oh, okay, he's distressed because his sons have all left him. Therefore, he's you know, possibly thinking of, well, you know, I should give all this up, because, you know, like this, Prabhupada uses introduces this concept of smarsan bhairagya. So smarsan means the burning gut. So when people go when their relatives die, they go to the crematorium or cremation grounds or whatever, and they think, you know, they start to think, oh, you know, this life is such a misery, you know, why should I waste my time? I should just give it all up. Just like we saw at the start of the pandemic, it was really interesting. A lot of people were talking about, you know, because they're suffering because of, you know, it was revealed that this pandemic came because of meat eating. You know, that it came from these wet markets. This is what they're saying. Came from these wet markets in China. And therefore, people were drawing a direct connection between meat eating and the pandemic. So you see, like, there's a lot of, like, on social media stuff, people say, oh, yeah, I'm going to give up meat. You know, I'm going to give up eating meat. It's cruel to the animals, but it's actually very bad for your health. But how many people did? It's usually a temporary thing because there's not a lot of depth of realization. But then we see, and the same thing with Daksha. He didn't actually have a lot of depth of realization on that, but he did. But the point I'm making is that that Narad Muni, he's a brilliant preacher, and he uses so many different strategies and tactics to try to awaken people's Krishna consciousness. He urged them to follow their brothers if they were all affectionate toward them. Family affection is very strong, and therefore Narad Muni followed this tactic of reminding them of their family relationship with the Haryashvas. Generally, the word Nigama refers to the Vedas, but here Nigama refers to the instructions contained in the Vedas. Srimad Bhagavatam says, Nigama Kalpa Talo Balita Balam. The Vedic instructions are like a tree of which the Srimad Bhagavatam is the ripened fruit. And we see, like with the Vedas, you know, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu points out that in the Vedas there's actually only three really real topics. Does anyone know the topics that the Vedas of Mahaprabhu points out? Sambandha, Abhidaya, Prayojana. They're the only three topics in the Vedas. And so we see that the Veda is also talking about who we are, what our relationship is, the process, and the goal. And the Bhagavatam really focuses in, defines that goal very, very explicitly for us as being, you know, achieving this love of Godhead and going back to the spiritual realm. So therefore we see it as being explained here as this Galitam Phalam, is this you know, the ripened fruit of the tree of the Veda. Narad Muni is engaged in distributing this fruit, and therefore he instructed Vyasadeva to write this Mahapurana, Srimad Bhagavatam, for the benefit of the ignorant human society. So we see, you know, like oftentimes, even in this time, we'll see the same thing, is when a spiritual master has a particular mission that he's eager to push on, he engages his disciples in also promoting and developing that mission. The same we see with Srila Prabhupada. The main thing he engaged his disciples in many things, but the main thing he engaged his disciples in was printing and distributing transcendental literatures, because this was the instruction he received from his group. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said to Srila Prabhupada, you're an intelligent young man, you know, if you ever get money, I want you to translate and print books in the English language. So he did that. And he engaged his disciples in the same thing. So we see this is like, Prabhupada would often refer to this as the family business. And so we can see here also that this is Narad Muni's business, is he is engaged in propagation of Bhagavatam, or this knowledge of Krishna, so he's engaged his disciples, especially Srila Vyasadeva, in doing that. And then Prabhupada quotes this really wonderful verse from the seventh chapter of the first canto. Anata upashamam sakshad bhakti yogam and oxygen, lokasya janato vidhikans, chakri sattvatin salakitam. The material miseries of the entity, which has a purpose to him, can be directly mitigated by the linking process of promotional service. But the mass of people do not know this. Therefore, the Lord of Vyasadeva compiled this Vedic literature, which is in relation to the Supreme Truth. Srimad Bhagavatam 176. People are suffering because of ignorance and are following a wrong path to happiness. This is called tanata. These material activities will never make them happy. Therefore, Narada instructed Vyasadeva to record the instructions of Srimad Bhagavatam. Vyasadeva actually followed Narada and did this. Srimad Bhagavatam is the supreme instruction of the Vedas. Galatam Phalam, the ripened fruit of the Vedas, is Srimad Bhagavatam. So we see here this verse that the Prabhupada is quoting from the 7th chapter of the 1st canto. The evolution of the conversation there is chapters 4, 5, 6. Chapter 4 is the appearance of Narada. 5 and 6 is Narada instructing, or his conversation with Vyasa, and then him instructing Vyasa. And then the first 11 verses of the 7th chapter is the sages, I think the sages are asking, well, what did Narada do? What did Vyasa do after he received those instructions? And so that these first 11 verses are explaining that. And it concludes with the, because then he asks, you know, after this verse, he asks, well, why did Sukadeva Goswami, why did he engage in these difficult austerities? And then Sukadeva speaks the very well-known Aparambas Chumarayo, and explains that the reason he did this was because of his compassionate nature. But in this verse that Prabhupada is quoting here, very, very interesting. He starts off by saying, you know, the material misery living entity which are superfluous to him. So, you know, we find that in this material world that everyone identifies with the miseries that are happening to the body. But as we progress in devotional service, we can see, you know, even though we may not, as I was saying before, we may not be fully understanding this, we may not be fully realized, but we start to understand. In the beginning it's intellectually, but as we evolve it becomes more and more deep, and we actually start to have deep realizations. But these miseries that are happening to us, they're temporary, and they come and go. And Krishna makes this point in so many different ways in the Bhagavad Gita, but one way in particular he talks about it is in it's the second chapter, where he talks about how, he said, the non-permanent appearance of happiness and distress are just like the appearance and disappearance of someone with diseases. They arise from sense perception. Therefore, we need to learn to tolerate these things without being disturbed. So because of sense perception, because we see the body as a self, because we think that the body is a self, but actually this is not us. You know? And all it takes is just a little bit of logical analysis of the situation we can see. You know, I had, you know, a particular type of body when I was a baby, and then I evolved into a child, and the body changes, and we can see as we go through life how the body is changing. But it's interesting, is, you know, like the things I didn't like when I was, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 19 years old, I still don't like them now. I don't like cold weather. I don't like cold showers. I don't like, you know, any of these things. You know? I don't like certain types of food. I still don't like them. You know, no matter how much people try to convince me to eat guavas, I just cannot deal with them. It's like, no way. You know, but some people love them. But so this is my particular set of sentences, my particular guna and karma has put me in a situation where I don't like certain things, I do like other things. And we find that, you know, in certain conditions of life, certain living entities will respond in a very favorable way, and it helps them to, you know, evolve. But other people put in exactly the same position of life, in exactly the same condition, it's stifling for us, and restricting is limiting. You know, so it's all about the guna, karma, sense perception. It's all because I have this particular set of senses, this particular body, which is developed from my karma and situation from previous life. Therefore, in this life, I find things favorable and things unfavorable. But another person, even someone who could be my twin, would find the exact opposite. So this is just guna and karma associated with the particular entity. And therefore, if we understand how these things have evolved, we can also understand, as I say, at least intellectually beginning, that this is all just due to my particular set of senses. And by contemplating these things greatly, by discussing them and trying to understand, then our realization of these things will deepen, and we'll come to the point where we actually understand that I'm not this material body, and we'll act on that platform. I'm not this material body, I'm the spirit soul, eternal servant of Krishna. And that's why it's really important that we regularly discuss these topics. And Prabhupada would say to discuss them threadbare, meaning to discuss from all different angles, to see it from all different angles. Okay, it's like, you know, it's easy when you see suffering happen to someone else that you're not the body. You can say, you know, it's quite easy. But when it's happening to you, oh, my back hurts, and it's all me kind of thing, you know. But as we evolve spiritually, we can see that we start to understand more and more how this is not actually me. This is just the machine that's not functioning. It's just like, a friend lent me his car because he's in Brisbane, so he got his car to drive around it. And, it has, even though it's, a nice car, so-called nice car, it's got certain mechanical faults. But it's just a car, it's just a machine. And it doesn't matter how good a machine you have, at some point, after constant use, they wear down, they start to malfunction. So it's the same with the body. It's just a machine. It's a very sophisticated machine. It's a machine that can repair itself, which is pretty cool. You can imagine having a car that, someone bangs with your car, like a few months later, it repairs itself. I don't know if you sell a lot of them. But that's what the body's like. It's a machine, but it's a very, very sophisticated machine. But as with all machines, as you use them, they wear down. So as you get older, the lungs are wearing down, the digestion, the whole thing becomes all flabby. Just like in if you look at the intestines, they're all kind of like, all these little, I don't know what you call it, the sort of ribbed areas. So it's got a maximum area for absorbing the things that go through it, whatever nutrients you put into it. But then as you get older, the whole thing becomes all flabby and blocked up with different types of basically stool and things like that. And then the capacity to absorb is reduced. And then the fire of digestion also, it wears down and things like that. So you can see, and that's just a simple example, like joints. As the joints are moving constantly, then what happens is, there's little bits of lubricant kept in between the placement between the joints, but that wears out, that dries up. And so many things happen like that as you get older. But it's just the machine wearing down. And then by discussing these things and also experiencing these things, we can start to understand there is a separation between the body and the self. And so it's very important, and Prabhupada would regularly encourage the Buddhists to discuss these things threadbare. So we can understand this thing very, very clearly, how we're not this body, and we're a spirit soul, and we're Krishna's eternal servant. And we see also here that the Prabhupada, he's quoting this verse here, saying how these sufferings of the material body are superfluous. I mean, they're not actually directly connected with us. But the problem comes is when we identify with the body, then we identify with the suffering of the body. Therefore, we experience it. But if we understand that we're not this material body, we understand that the sufferings of the body are only related to the body, then we are able to detach ourselves from these things. And it gets to the point where they don't actually interfere with your practice of bhakti. They don't actually interfere anymore with your relationship with Krishna. But if we identify with these things, that gives them the potential to interfere with our relationship with Krishna. So it's very important verse here. And many important points that Srila Prabhupada brings out. And we could say so much more, but in the interest of time, I will finish there. Any comments or questions? It's pretty much. I saw your head first.
Thank you for the nice class. My question is a few verses down, and Daksha says that when he gets annoyed that not only took them away, Daksha says, They should have been allowed to procreate and live their life, and then when they're older, then that's their choice if they want to go. So actually in the ninth canto there's an interesting episode where Yadav, who's the son of Puru, was the son of Puru, Puravas. So there what happens is when Puravas says, I would like to, one of your sons to exchange your youth with me, Yadav says that I won't do it, because he says, he gives a really good explanation. He says that when one is young, he has to be given a chance to enjoy his life. Then he will be properly situated in the next ashram, monoprastha. Yeah. So, like when I read the purport, I thought Prabhupada slammed that. But actually, he says it's true what he's saying, that if they are not engaged, those preparatories are not properly engaged, then one will not be solidly situated when one actually takes it off. So, if there any, there's truth in. Like Daksha is basically saying that's the natural flow. So I'm saying there is weight in his argument that he puts to Narayana. There is weight in his argument that he puts to Narayana. That you shouldn't have taken them straight away.
Yeah, but then you see the same point is there in that pastime you just described, as is here, is Daksha's intention is to enjoy his life. And the same is, you know, what's he saying? Purana. He's saying, enjoy his life. But Narad Muni is coming from a completely different angle of vision. He's coming from the absolute perspective, whereas this is a relative perspective, because enjoyment is quite relative. You know, like for most of you, the weather here is quite nice. But, I mean, autumn in Melbourne is a nice time, but it's still a bit cold for me. Yeah. But I see most of you are sitting around in, you know, fairly light clothes. I've got a wool hoodie on, you know, because I find it cold here. But that's relative. It's relative to me. And not everyone sees it the same way. But then Narad Muni is speaking absolute instructions. He's speaking about the absolute truth. And he's seeing that these are intelligent people, and therefore he's giving them the opportunity to understand the absolute truth. Whereas Daksha, he's engaged in begetting children. That is not the absolute truth. That is a relative thing that's associated with the true world. Of course, you know, as I mentioned before, that for devotees to get married and have children so they can become Christians, to try to raise Krishna conscious children, is also an activity connected with Krishna. So it's ultimately liberating, it's ultimately purifying. But we need to understand that those persons who, generally speaking, not always, but generally speaking, those persons who get married to have children, there are some desires there in their heart. Therefore, they need to get married in order to overcome those desires. Of course, there are people who do get married exclusively for the purpose of doing service for Krishna. But I can tell you, in fact, I'm on that level. And I don't know how many devotees are, but some I'm sure are at that level. But that's a very, very advanced level.
So that was like an express fact. Like in Mansan Daksha was saying, like they were national or whatever. But
Malvin
had the express
higher
solution.
Yeah. And he's completely transcendental, because these other perspectives are coming from the material plane. It's a material consciousness, ultimately. Even though they may be, we see Daksha, he's a very, very advanced person, very, very advanced materials, a very, very powerful materials. The fact that he can have 11,000 sons is pretty impressive. Yeah.
In the past, the Lord says that although he granted this boon to Daksha, he didn't really favor him. And that was like, wait a minute, how can the Lord not favor someone? And now based on all this, can we say, I was thinking how it's like the child throws a tantrum and the parent says, okay, have it, even though it's not good for you. The classic example Prabhupada gives. So it looks like, would that be a case here? And then when Arjuna comes, that's why, even though it was against the Lord's instruction, he didn't drink.
No, I don't know if Daksha was throwing a tantrum at that point. You think he throws a bit of a tantrum later on when he curses Narayana Muni. But the point is like Daksha had material desires. He wanted to be able to procreate, and the procreate was very powerful, and that's why he approached the Lord. And you know, we see sometimes in different pastimes, Krishna will give people material facility if necessary. But if they're interested in bhakti, you know, and the material facility is ultimately, it's not really a benediction, even though the materialist may think, wow, look at what I've got, you know. Like, I mean, so often you meet people and brag about their material possessions, and you think, well, so what? You know, what does it mean, really? But if the Lord's bestowing his favor upon you, it means he's awarding you with pure and loving devotion. And this is a rare thing to achieve. And one can only achieve pure bhakti by the causeless mercy of the Lord. It's not like something you can go out and you know, and we see, like, if you look at the chapter 4 of the first canto, this chapter describes Narada's appearance and how he, you know, after his mother passed away, he left the Mahabharata devotees, and then he sat down by the water and he meditated upon the Lord. The Lord appeared out of his causeless mercy. Yet he spent the rest of his life trying to see the Lord again. He didn't appear. Even though a greatly qualified person like Narada couldn't force the Lord's hand. So it's out of great mercy and compassion that we actually get the favor of the Lord.
But the Lord is the well-wishing friend of all living entities. So
that's right.
He should be getting all these spiritual benefits.
Yeah, but the thing is, it's also a matter of qualification. That, you know, what's the point of giving something, you know, like okay, a child, you're going to give like a 5-year-old child, and they have a toy Lamborghini, and they say, Daddy, buy me a Lamborghini, like a real one. And so you buy the child a Lamborghini, gets the Lamborghini, doesn't know how to drive, crashes into a pole, kills him. It's by qualification. You get these things by qualification. What's the point of giving someone something they're not qualified to use it? You know, or giving a child a handgun, a loaded gun. You know, they don't know how to use it, they'll play games, they'll shoot their friends or shoot themselves and stuff like that.
But he could have, I've been on
here
for a long time, but he could have given him
something
tailor-made for him.
He did. He gave him something tailor-made for him. He had the desire to procreate. See, that was his desire. And unless one's willing to give up these material desires, you know, there's no point awarding them the benediction of pure bhakti, because they'll get that, you know, they'll practice bhakti and they'll go back to material desires. One has to cleanse the heart. And this is the point that Prabhupada's making by quoting the verse, anatha upagama shakshat. You have to get rid of these anathas before you actually understand, because you know, the living entity is attached to all these things. They're seeing that this is my path of enjoyment. And as long as they have that desire, this is my path of enjoyment, this is the desire to achieve these things, they can never really fully come to the point of bhakti. Bhakti means being free from all these things. Yes, Maharaj.
Thank you, Guru. Actually, I just wanted to also like ask Dr. Amanda Mansur, but when you mean qualification, like that would mean more like even free will to some extent, right? Because we see free will, because we see that Narada Muni, he instructed Hariyashras and the next, the 1000 sons, but you know, they just immediately listened to him, like they did not argue or anything like that, like they just took the instruction and they just followed it. Whereas we see with Daksha, when Narada Muni, like after the 1000 sons, you see the Daksha is like cursed him, like it was almost like a rebel kind of a thing.
Yeah.
So that's what I just wanted to say. So it's also the free will, right? Because the like as we were discussing, that the Lord might want to give, and I think you were saying about qualification, yeah, but if you don't have that the desire is not strong enough for complete surrender to Krishna. And
yeah.
So it's like because you know, Krishna won't force Also, the Brahmanas,
it has to be. Yeah. Well, we see like with the Hayashras and the Shavalashras, is that they were very qualified, they were very learned, they were very renounced, they were very detached, but also they were humble. That was the quality that Daksha was lacking. It didn't have humility. Like if you look earlier on, Prabhupada, actually Vishnu Shakari Thakur, and Prabhupada quotes Vishnu Shakari Thakur, describes that the reason that Daksha wound up cursing him is because there was still some residual envy from his interaction with Shiva, and he was still, suffering the effects of his offense to Lord Shiva. And so when Narad Muni, preached to his sons to be, to follow the path of Paramahansa, and they did, that envy came up again. And so it's one thing that you'll often see. It's like, people can practice, renunciation, they can practice a spiritual path, and they can practice so many things, sense control, mind control, stuff like that. But if there's, residual anarchas within the heart, all you have to do is you push their buttons in the right way, and you'll see that these things will come out. And so, even though Daksha is presenting himself as being an elevated, transcendental so-called, we see that when he was agitated in a particular way, then the anger came out again. So you can understand that's there in the heart. And it's the same for us. And better we don't look at others, their situation, look at our own situation. We see, what's there in my heart that I need to remove, so that when these things happen, that I don't become agitated, that I'm able to think of Krishna. But you'll see there's so many stories we see in the Bhagavatam where people are pushed in particular ways and the anger comes out, or the greed or the lust or whatever, these things come out. So the process of bhakti helps us to remove these anarchas. That's the whole point of Vaidisadha bhakti. This anartha nivritti, it means like destroying or removing the anarchas. So Daksha hadn't achieved that point, whereas the Hayashras and Shavalashras, because they were humble, they accepted Narayana's instructions, and therefore they were able to cleanse themselves of any anarchas they may have had. But because Daksha wasn't humble, because he had envy, therefore he acted in a way that was ultimately not for his own good. And Narayana really was fine with it. And you can see this also, this pastime shows you a very distinct difference between a pure Vaishnava and a materialistic person. Materialistic person, as soon as you agitate them, anger, envy, hatred, these things come out. Whereas Narayana, pure Vaishnava, Daksha's cursing him. He's saying some pretty harsh things. In this day and age, someone says these things, But in this time, the very cultured people, Prabhupada's strongest word was rascal. When you call someone a rascal now, so is that all you've got? But he's saying, if you look at the culture there, you can see that, he's saying, you're not a devotee. You hang out with Lord Vishnu, but you're not qualified to hang out with Lord Vishnu. All these other persons are so much more qualified. Narayana Muni is very, very highly qualified. But because he doesn't have envy in his heart, because he doesn't have pride, he's okay. But the Rambam says, whatever you offer, that's good. I accept that. Because he's humble, because he's a pure unalloyed Vaishnava. So you can see it's a wonderful pastime for demonstrating the difference between a non-devotee and an advanced devotee. So it's good lessons for us in these pastimes also.
Yeah. I think that's just a non-devotee.
A materialistic person. Yeah, it's a materialistic person.
Otherwise you wouldn't say Lord Vishnu.
Yeah, it's definitely a materialistic person. But I'm making the point that it demonstrates the difference between the two situations and how a great leader, because Prabhupada would say, you judge a thing by the results, you can judge something by the symptoms. So we can see with Daksha, the way he responded indicated that there were things in his heart. Whereas we can see the way that Narayana Muni responded, we can see he's very pure.
I think it's also teaches us to recognize the differences between devotees.
Yeah.
Not all devotees, a devotee is good, but not all devotees are motivated with the same motivations.
Yeah, exactly.
And that is quite the epitome of pure devotion.
Yeah.
So you can go anywhere he likes.
Yeah. And the epitome of a preacher.
Yes.
He's the most amazing preacher. He just takes the holy name everywhere. Yeah.
And Dutch is kind of a bit of an attached. He's the epitome of the attached householder.
Yeah. These pastimes are so wonderful to help us understand the situation in the real world. And there's a nice purport in the first canto where Srila Prabhupada is glorifying Narada Muni, and he says, "We are very thankful to Narada Muni for appearing in the pages of Srimad Bhagavatam." Mm-hmm. So it's very nice. There's many, many wonderful pastimes of Narada Muni.
You know, contrast to Daksha is Ambarish Maharaj.
Yeah.
Right. So, just because, and this kind of pastime presents the dichotomy between the sannyasis, if you like, and the householders, but and the conflict, between potential conflict. But if you look at Ambarish Maharaj, he's a very detached householder. And so there's not always that conflict between householders and sannyasis, especially when there's detachment on both sides. But the danger of and this teaches us the danger of householder life is when one's blessed with opulence and position or whatever.
That can
be detrimental to your spiritual progress.
Especially if you're attached to it.
That's right.
Yeah. Thank you. Supa Bhakti, Samaritabhakti Vinniki, Jai Nityai Gopurendranandi.
Thank you.